The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with the Watford blogger, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And the peacock of Coventry, Daniel
Freeba. I saw a peacock today and I thought of myself. Anyway.
What an admission. Somebody on Twitter suggested that they actually translated it into German.
Pfau aus Berlin. Yeah, I quite like that. Anyway.
We'll look it up and use that. Maybe a t-shirt in the future. How are you both decompressing after the Giro?
Not too bad. What about you chaps? I mean, it's been tough all weekend, isn't it?
Grueling. It has, isn't it? Lionel, how are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, looking forward, not back, but obviously looking back a little bit in this episode, answering listeners' questions. Yeah,
this episode is our third press conference, we call it. It's a bit presumptuous, isn't it?
Any of the questions that we've received? How many seconds did Chris Froome gain on the descent off the Colle delle Finestre?
Well, I mean, Chris Froome's performance on Friday and subsequent win in the Giro d'Italia, it changed the whole texture of the race and the coverage of the race, didn't it? And it's been interesting. It's been an interesting few days. So we're going to answer a few of your questions. A lot of you have been leaving questions on WhatsApp with using the voice memo there. We did a couple of these during the Giro. They went okay, so we're going to do it again. This is for this week's podcast. I feel I should be asking you for the tale of the tapper, Lionel.
Well, there's been no tapper today, has there? So
have you been out on your bike?
Not today.
So you can't even give us that?
No. I did ride over the weekend, though. It was quite nice to get out and just enjoy the fresh air and the solitude.
Okay, well, shall we just crack on with these questions? Well, we go to number one.
Hello, Richard, Lionel, and Daniel. This is David, a friend of the podcast. I've just become a friend of the podcast this year, and I've really enjoyed this year's specials and the back catalog of previous year's specials. I'll also say that I've noticed your coverage of the cycling year seems to really complement my mood as we go through the season. When we were in Italy, for example, the year is young, and it seems like there's always time to taste the wine or have a cappuccino before noon. In fact, I'll admit, I sometimes even associate the atmosphere of specific tours to each of your on-air personalities, but I don't want your responses to shatter any illusions I have, so I won't say which is who. My question is about the roles of leader and domestique. The way these roles are discussed during a race, it sometimes seems like these roles are very fluid and that someone can pass back and forth quite easily. Yet I've noticed that leaders seem to try to distance themselves from any idea that they could be a domestique. Certainly, when a leader wins, there's effusive praise for their domestiques. Yet, a memorable moment in Lionel's recent friend special comes to mind when Roger de Vlaeminck overhears the word domestique in a separate conversation Lionel is having with Jan, who is translating, and Roger felt the need to immediately clarify that he was never a domestique. This incident, and just generally how I think about Froome and Nibali, have prompted me to ask you all, what really is the relationship between the roles of leader and domestique? Is the barrier between these two roles permeable? If a leader is having a bad time in a long stage race, is it maybe better for their career that they would play up that illness and leave the race rather than be seen riding as a domestique? Would riding in that role very visibly just once contaminate their career as a leader from then on? Am I correct in believing that the famous leaders of the past always seem to leave the sport when they can no longer win rather than ride for other people? Thanks so much for all your great work.
It's an interesting question, that one. The hierarchy in a team is obviously, it's quite strictly observed, really, isn't it? The leader is a GC contender, but perhaps less so when, you know, the teams have a less defined and less obvious leader. A team like Quickstep, for example, on the sprint days would treat Elia Viviani as if he were as precious to them as a GC contender was to, say, Sky or Sunweb or Astana. The question about riders not wanting to contaminate their careers by, you know, if they're having a bad time, then dedicating themselves to the team. I think possibly in this Giro, the clearest example of that would be Fabio Aru, who, first of all, didn't really have an obvious second in command to work for. The whole team was based around him. But Aru didn't look like, there was any other, he wasn't going to do anything else for the team. He was, you know, he was a leader, and when that didn't work out, basically, I think, fairly keen to write off the whole Giro and subsequently pulled out of the race. So I think the hierarchy is fairly set, isn't it? Except in, you know, perhaps a team like, well, I'm thinking somebody like BMC, where on certain days, Alessandro De Marchi would sort of assume almost a sort of leadership role, in the sense that, you know, they would try to get him up the road, and once he's up the road, everybody else sort of more or less has a day off. It's not a terribly fluid thing, I wouldn't have thought, in the Grand Tours.
Well, the more capable the leader is, and the more likely he is to win, the more rigid the hierarchy within that team, I would say. And so, the you know, as you go down in terms of quality of leader, you have a bit more of a kind of democratic system at play. But I mean, most professional riders are domestiques rather than leaders, and you know, that's an adjustment that most professionals have to make from amateur days, when you know, you don't get a professional contract on the basis of how good a domestique you are. You get a contract on how good your results are as an amateur. So it's quite a switch in mindset. And I mean, a very good book, if you're not familiar with it, is Charlie Wigelius's book called Domestique. He was a climbing domestique for many years, and really his fulfillment of that role came about because he realized, I mean, he was a very good under 23 rider, won a lot of big races, but he realized when he turned pro that he wasn't going to be a winner, and so the only way for him to have a long career was to turn himself into a team worker, which he did, and which most riders do.
The other obvious example from the Giro was somebody whose role changed quite dramatically in the final week, Mikel Nieve, who was part of the Mitchelton Scott team looking after Simon Yates. And then obviously once Simon Yates fell quite spectacularly out of contention, he then was given an opportunity to ride for himself, and did so to great effect on stage 20 and won the stage. That opportunity obviously would not have come along had Simon Yates still been in the pink jersey, of course. As for Yates, I mean, once he was out of the pink jersey and completely out of contention, it's not, I would be surprised if he was then on kind of, you know, fetching bottles and duty and that kind of thing. I think he was just allowed to kind of ride through and just get through to the finish in Rome.
Well, I think the permeability or the fluidity of the system has increased over the years. I mean, it used to be almost a feudal system. The serfs were obliged to live on the lord's land, i.e. live on the land of their team leader and pay him homage and labour and a share of the produce.
Well, that's certainly the point that Johan de Moink made about Roger de Vlaminck, the friend special that David referred to there.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is a longtime friend of the podcast, Alex. I live in North Carolina, expat from the United Kingdom. I have a few questions about your personal logistics when you do these 2 to 3 week jaunts. For example, can you tell us how many pairs of underwear you take for these long trips?
Well, interesting question, Alex. Thank you for that. How many pairs of pants do you take on a grand tour? I just take as many as days there are before I'll get to Londres. So you on one of the rest days, and there used to be only one rest day at the Tour de France and the other grand tours. Now there are two and sometimes even three. But on the second rest day, we try and get to Londres and do the washing. So you take as much clothes as you need for the first, well, 2 weeks, basically. That's it. I mean, when you say logistics, I presume you mean more than just pants. But I appreciate that's obviously a very important consideration.
Well, the rule is anything up to that rest day plus one, just in case there's not a laundrette in the rest day town. But then it becomes a case of emergency if you don't get to the laundrette on the rest day. During the Giro, we were very fortunate to stay somewhere where they offered to do our laundry for us for a very modest fee. That was really very welcome indeed. But in terms of other kinds of logistics, Well, he doesn't ask about any other kind of logistics. He's just interested in pants. Incredible.
I mean, one of the challenges in the traveling with Daniel, no offense, Daniel, but Daniel runs a lot and washes his running gear and then has it laid out in the back of the car drying. Which after a few days does affect the freshness,
yeah, slightly.
The freshness of the air.
But as regards underwear, we're getting close to scatological territory, so I'm not going to answer that question.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thanks as ever to our main sponsor, Rafa. Just a word this week for the new Rafa Race Radio series. They have produced some short films from the Giro. They've been producing short films from most of the major races this year. And it's really, from the fans' perspective, it's the roadside experience. So the episodes from the Giro are from the Zonkalan, the Finestre, and in Rome, where the race finished, of course, on Sunday. They are short films, and you will find them on YouTube if you search Rafa Race Radio. Now, coming up in mid-June is the Cycling Revival Festival at Herne Hill, celebrating 200 years of the bicycle. We have been, you, the listeners, are offered free tickets for this. Tickets are from £39 each. It's over 3 days from the 14th to the 16th of June. And there are lots of events. It's hosted by friend of the podcast, Ned Bolting. Graham O'Brien is one of the many stars who will be in action there. If you email lucy@cyclingrevival.com, that's lucy@cyclingrevival.com, and put the Cycling Podcast in the subject line of your email and ask for free tickets, you will get complimentary tickets. And as I say, they start at £39, so that's a great offer. And Lucy, thank you very much. Friend of the podcast, Lucy, I should add. Shall we move on to the next question?
Good morning, Daniel, Richard and Lionel. This is Richard calling from Suffolk in the UK, very hilly part of the UK, as I'm sure you all know. Thanks for what you do with your podcast. Been really enjoying the Kilometer Zeros as a friend of the podcast, and also obviously your daily reports from the Giro d'Italia. Keep it up. Really, really enjoy it. My question, a bit late, I know, but perhaps you can cover this in one of your daily shows, is aimed really at Lionel, given his recent anointing of Simon Yates as the flying back pudding. I wonder if he's forgotten the fact that Simon has a brother, Adam, who also shows tour-winning potential and therefore presumably is also worthy of a nickname of his own. The only other regional delicacy that I can think of hailing from Lancashire is a hot pot, and I wondered if he'd got any designs on using that for Adam, because I'm sure Lionel wouldn't want to leave Adam out.
Well, Richard, I can't see the flying Lancashire hot pot taking off for Adam Yates at the Tour de France, and we can't really do the same thing again, and we're not going to call Adam Yates the...
What do you mean we, Lionel? This was very much your hobby horse, this one.
Boudin Noir Rapide, would it be? I don't know. It was an interesting few days, this, because, the whole thing came up off the back of Daniel and I taking a short detour off the Giro route one day to visit the so-called and the fake Zonkalan of the South. And the origin of this was that some cycling fans on forums had created a myth around a mountain that was supposedly harder than the Zonkalan, and a whole kind of story. Well,
what's this got to do with black pudding?
Newspapers. Well, this is where I'm explaining my thought process so when we went and recorded a bit and we played that in the episode, and it was the day that Chris Froome fell off going uphill and Richard Carapaz won the stage, I think stage 8. Anyway, we're in the press room and I just Googled what is black pudding in Italian, and it's sanguinaccio. And then I asked Daniel, what would flying black pudding or quick black pudding be? And he said, well, sanguinaccio volante. And in the episode, after we talked about the fake Zonkalan of the South, I kind of said, I wonder if we can get a nickname to catch on. Not really expecting anyone to take it up or do anything with it. And within a few days, it had grown a small life of its own. Somebody had designed a T-shirt with a Flying Black Pudding logo. Somebody sent in a piece of artwork of a piece of black pudding riding a bicycle.
Not everybody liked it, though, did they? Some people thought it was disrespectful, which I found puzzling.
Yeah, they did. At one of the press conferences, I asked a question of Simon Yates. I think I was the first person to ask a question of his at the press conference that evening. And after he'd given an answer, he just sort of said as an aside, I'm not too sure about that nickname, by the way, and laughed. And so he was obviously not bothered in the slightest by it, maybe slightly bemused, perhaps, or what have you. But yeah, it was interesting seeing a reaction from some people, a very small number of people. But I mean, this is one of the things about cycling that I did make in. I made the point that riders in the past have had nicknames based on all kinds of things. And it certainly wasn't meant to be taking a mickey, that's for sure. But I don't think we'll be bestowing a similar nickname on Adam Yates at the Tour de France, that's for sure.
Hello, it's Phil here from West Central Scotland. I'd just like to say thanks a lot for your coverage of the Giro. I've really enjoyed it this year. Cycling Podcast is an open, outward-looking, cosmopolitan thing in an increasingly insular media landscape. So it's rapidly becoming my favourite media. And my question is about Philippa York's latest column. I don't know if you've read it, where she takes quite a hard line on Chris Froome's performance, particularly in light of how poor he was going into the Giro, and seems to regard this whole concept of riders riding themselves into form over a grand tour as nonsense. So could you give me your comments on that, please? Thanks.
Well, that's an interesting question, Phil. You're referring to an article written by Philippa York, formerly Robert Miller, of course, questioning the claim that Chris Froome rode into form over the course of the Giro. That article was published by Cycling News. I think that this is slightly misunderstood, this notion. Although I don't know, and I'd be very interested to speak to physiologists about this. But my understanding of it would be that a little bit like I think I said this on Twitter, but in a 100-meter sprint, it looks like Usain Bolt would speed up from 60 to 100 metres. Most people, well, everybody, in fact, slows down from 60 or 70 metres. In fact, Bolt and Tyson, sorry to go into athletics here, but Bolt and Tyson Gear, I think, are the only recorded sprinters who've accelerated up to 70 metres. So they're all slowing down, but Bolt is slowing down less rapidly than the other ones. And it looks as though he is speeding up. Now, I think that over the course of 3 weeks, it's kind of the same, that some people get tired more quickly than others do. And so the rate of fatigue varies from rider to rider. Now, you know, you could come back at me and say, well, you know, Froome was riding better in week three than he was in week one in terms of power and so on. But maybe that's when he had to make those kind of efforts. Who knows? Like I say, I would be fascinated to speak to physiologists about this claim, but certainly traditionally guys that win Grand Tours are the guys whose bodies hold up better than other bodies, with all that implies.
I think, Rich, on this notion of riding into form, you know, whether we ourselves have the physiological know-how to be able to answer that question with any certainty, it's something that we hear every single year. There is always a rider who comes into the Tour or the Vuelta, the Tour or the Giro, very often it's the Giro, because you do get guys wanting to at least do the Giro and the Tour, and they say that they have calibrated their training to try to come into form in the last half of the race. And another reason for that is that the Giro increasingly over the last few years has stacked its difficulties very much towards the back end of the third week. So there are certainly guys out there who, at least in their utterances to the media and the public, lead us to believe that you can ride yourself into form. And another thing is whether the question of whether Froome was really riding himself into form or nursing himself back to full health. And, you know, again, people might say, well, there was a lot of spin from Team Sky, but we certainly did hear midway through the race that the crash in Israel on the Recce in Jerusalem had affected him much more seriously than was first thought and feared, and it took him at least a week to heal from the injuries and to feel himself again. And then there were other issues. There was he fell again at Montevergine, and we knew that at the Tour of the Alps he'd been suffering with bad saddle sore. We understand that that deteriorated during the tour, and it was pretty bad at the start of the last week. But again, you know, people would say that's simply spin coming out of Team Sky. It might be, it might not be. But there is the possibility that Froome was healthier at the rear end of the Giro than he was at the start. The other issue, which not many people have focused on, but again, I'm just sort of throwing it out there, it was the issue of weather. It had been a pretty cold Giro, certainly compared to last year, and Chris Froome has generally gone well in hot weather. And there was one day on this Giro that was noticeably hotter than all of the others, pretty sure that was the case. It was certainly hotter than most of the others. That's just a few things. I mean, there's a very broad constellation of factors that would need to be evaluated when coming up with an answer as to how probable, how credible the performance is. But in reality, these sort of at a distance, I can't call it fag packet physiology or fag packet dope testing, these kind of calculations are not going to get us any closer to the real answer of whether it was a clean performance or not.
I was a bit surprised a statement like that was made with absolute certainty and without any kind of evidence to kind of back it up.
From Philippa York, you mean?
From Philippa York, yeah. I mean, obviously can't dispute her credibility at having ridden Grand Tours and finished on the podium at the Giro and the Vuelta and won the King of the Mountains at the Tour de France and knows what it takes and knows the toll that a three-week tour has on the body. But if we just think about the notion of form, I mean, it's a shorthand term, isn't it? What actually is it? You know, form is as much a kind of a mental as physical thing. As you say, Richard, in the third week, a rider's numbers may be down, but if they're less down compared to the rivals, then the sensations, as they say, will be good relative to the other riders. I mean, George Bennett made this point in the podcast. It doesn't matter how good you are if everyone else is going better. That's one of the unavoidable truths of bike racing. What I would say is that form, whatever it is, this sort of tricky to define thing, it is presumably a bell curve, whether it's a bell curve with a tall bell curve or quite a shallow one. Riders go on hard training camps, don't they, where they do a variety of work. They do a lot of volume, they do intensity, they do motor pacing, they may do altitude work. They are effectively preparing for the type of efforts that they're going to be making in Grand Tours. And when we talk about form, a rider who may overdo the training or overdo the racing prior to the Tour de France may be closer to the peak of that bell curve at the start of the race than the next man. And so I think it's impossible to say you can't dismiss the notion that a rider can ride into a better condition relative to all of the other competitors. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of former pros over the last day or so, and the idea of feeling good in the last week despite being very fatigued, I mean, I'm not talking about a rider of Chris Froome's level, but it's not unusual that riders feel relatively good in the last week, even though they're extremely tired.
You always feel good when you drop people. I mean, everybody.
Well, yeah, and I don't know. I think it was just an unusual comment from my point of view. Reading it, it did make me sort of sit up and look and go, well, that's a really bold claim because, like I say, a form has to, there has to be a kind of a peak to it. Otherwise, why would riders go on training camps? What are they seeking to do by training, by taking on a large amount of physical work in order to get ready for a race? And what point are they saying, well, I've done enough now and I think I'll be good at the key points in the Giro or in the Tour de France? I mean, I think it was a dubious claim. And like you, I'd like to actually follow that up with a coach, sports scientist, between now and the tour, and see if we can get some answers.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The intervention of Seb Piquet there reminds us to tell you that this week's episode sponsor is Moneybox. Moneybox sponsored an episode during the Giro d'Italia as well. It's a simple way to save and invest. It's a mobile-only app that allows you to round up your everyday purchases to the nearest pound and invest the spare change. So when you buy a coffee for £2.40, for example, you can automatically invest the 60 pence change, and you can invest in companies such as Netflix, Tesla and Nike via simple tracker funds. Lionel, I've signed up actually now on the back of your recommendation because you've been using it for a while. How's your fund doing?
Yeah, it's doing well at the moment. Since I got back from the Giro, I've been out and about. I've had a few coffees out. I've bought sundries in the supermarket and filled the car with petrol and stuff. And then, you know, once you've made all these transactions on, once I'd made all those transactions on my debit card, a day or so later, I just check the app and choose which of those transactions I want to round up to the nearest pound. And it's a bit like, well, it's a digital penny jar, really. And all of that money plus, I actually add a set amount each week as well. So it's totting up. And then you can keep an eye on how it's doing and look at the interest rate and look at how much it's made. And I'm pretty happy
all
at
right,
the moment.
All right. No need to show off, Lionel. Wow. Billionaire Bernie. how long will it take you to be able to run a pro team?
Well, it's going to be a little way from that. But what I like about it is it's kind of saving without really thinking. That's,
I like not thinking.
Well, yeah. Because you kind of think, oh, I just want to tuck a little bit away here or there. And it's just an easy way to do it because it's on your phone and, you're just literally choosing whether to swipe left or right, whether to round up those transactions and add that little bit extra to your fund. So, yeah, it's working well at the moment.
So join 100,000 people investing in their future with Moneybox. As with all investing, your capital is at risk and you may get back less than you invest. Visit the App Store or Play Store to download the Moneybox app today.
That's the Moneybox app. Visit the App Store or Play Store to download it.
Hi, chaps. Adam Cotham from Warwickshire here, long-time friend of the podcast. We're all familiar with the concept of riding a la Zubeldia to secure 8th, 9th or 10th place in the GC, but where do you think the tipping point comes in the GC standings? So who do you think is the lowest-placed rider that will be happy with their final GC position?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Adam. Who is the lowest placed rider who would be happy with their final GC position? I mean, Daniel, you've made the point quite a lot that the stakes are a little bit higher at the Tour de France and perhaps riders in the top 10, 15, 20 might ride a little bit more conservatively to hold on to those positions. And it's maybe slightly different at the Giro and the Vuelta. But just picking a name, chaps, who would you say? How low down would you go?
Well, I'm just... The name that's sucking my attention is Rohan Dennis. Not so much to address the question that we've been asked, but I just think it's a really interesting sort of dilemma that he's got and BMC have got. I mean, I think he showed enough in 2.5 weeks to pursue this idea that he could be a GC rider. However, you look at the time gap that he finished with, 56 minutes down and 16th place. That's a fairly hefty tariff at the end of a Grand Tour. And I know you could say that Simon Yates has an even bigger one, but I don't think he left anyone in any doubt that he can be a Grand Tour contender in the future. But I would be quite curious to know how Rowan Dennis and BMC will evaluate their Giro.
Here's another question, Daniel. When we woke up on Friday morning, if I told you that Simon Yates was going to finish 1 hour and 15 minutes down on GC, what would you have thought?
Well, I feared at one point in the 19th stage that we almost had a wager, didn't we, Rich, in the press room? You don't really understand betting. You don't really understand odds. You tried to offer me odds of evens that he was going to abandon the race. I said, it wouldn't surprise me if Simon Yates abandoned now on the Colle delle Finestre. And you said, okay, yeah, well, I'll bet you £100. Mm-hmm. So I was going to get, yeah, so... If he'd abandoned, they weren't great odds, were they? But you don't.
What position justifies riding Ala Zubeldia, i.e. riding for GC, riding conservatively to try and manage your efforts as well as possible over 3 weeks? Is it top 10? Is it top 15? Does it depend what stage you're at as a rider? I mean, looking at the GC, you know, there are guys like Sam Omen will be happy, very happy, I think, the ninth overall. Even Wout Poels, you know, he did a good job for Froome, finished 12th overall.
The ones in the kind of grey area for me would be George Bennett, Davide Formolo. I mean, Formolo will look... he had one bad day, didn't he? And if you take that bad day away, I think it was it the Stage to Etna? Where he lost about 5 or 6 minutes. If you take that away, then he's probably exactly where he would think he would be. But I think they're the guys who... there's a question to be asked whether they will be happy, whether they should be happy, whether their teams are happy. But I think generally, I mean, as a fan, as a spectator, as a you know, I don't really necessarily approve of people defending eighth position or seventh position on GC. I think sort of top six is usually for most guys, it's a decent result in the Grand Tours. It was particularly in the Tour de France, so there are only two or three guys in the world for whom that wouldn't be a big breakthrough to finish sixth in the Tour de France.
I think you have to look at the time. I think you have to look at the time gaps as well, because if you take 11th place, Alexandre Genies of AG2R finished 17 and a half minutes down. Then the next two riders are Wout Poels, who's 10 seconds behind him, and Sergio Henao, who's 29 minutes 41. Now, Poels and Henao were working for Chris Froome. So, if you like, Genies is the last man in the GC race, really, because after that, you're into Goncalves of Katusha, 34 minutes, Betancourt. Rowan Dennis, who was riding GC and obviously shipped a load of time right at the end. Everybody else is kind of out of it. So I'd say Genies, you would say he would probably be fairly happy with 11th place there and you know, only a couple of minutes or so away from a top 10. And I think as time goes on, people kind of forget the way the race played out and the result becomes more important. So in sort of 3-4 years time, people will look at, wow, Patrick Conrad finished 7th in the Giro, George Bennett 8th, Sam Omen 9th. You know, the results take on a different complexion as time goes on. But to answer the guys, to answer Adam's question, I'd say Giuseppe Fonzi would be the last man, the lowest man, happy with his final GC position, finishing in last place, 149th, 5 hours 48 down. The so-called, is it the black jersey?
Yes.
That used to be awarded. I'd say he'd be pretty happy having got round.
To really simplify it, just as a final word, chaps, as far as the GC guys are concerned, I would say that par is your previous best finish in a Grand Tour for most, well, for most of them under the age of about 30. And, you know, I asked the question about George Bennett. Well, George Bennett's previous best finish in a Grand Tour was 10th in the Vuelta, so 8th place is a pretty good return.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. And of course, you can still get your 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. My dad sent me a photograph yesterday of his table in his garden absolutely covered in Science and Sport products. He's been using that code He's feeling very pleased with himself indeed. So watch out for a flying 71-year-old in the Edinburgh area if you're out on your bike. Absolutely flying. I'm not sure if he has people out on the road handing him up gels and bottles and things, a la Froome. But anyway, one other piece of business from the Giro. We have a final competition winner. Congratulations to Deborah Jason. You've won some lovely Rafa kit and a full endurance bundle from Science and Sport. I think you've won the Pro Team Arenberg glasses from Rafa and, as I say, a full endurance bundle from Science and Sport. That's Deborah Jason. Congratulations to you. And if you email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, we will arrange for you to get your prizes. Thank you, everybody who joined in the social media competitions over the Giro. It was really great, actually. We got lots of nice feedback and other feedback on social media. We're very grateful to all of you who have offered feedback. Social media, also on iTunes reviews. There was an iTunes review today that really tickled me. I'll read out just one line of it, shall I? When there are only two of us on the podcast, it's usually better when Lionel is one of them. Otherwise, it tends towards slight negativity. Lionel, you're a ray of sunshine.
Yep. Well, podcast Lionel is.
Real one. This reviewer. I mean, if you knew the real Lionel.
Regular everyday Lionel is just wandering around with a cloud over his head. But podcast Lionel, it's like every day is, the day dawns with bird song and sunshine.
But speaking of feedback and divided feedback, I mean, I mentioned at the start that as soon as Froome rode into the pink jersey, the whole tone of everything changed. It was a bit like a cloud came over the Giro in a way. For some people, were
toxic,
very happy about it.
A nuclear Chernobyl. Well, some type style cloud.
Yeah, well, some people enjoyed, you know, the spectacular attack, but a lot of others were sceptical. And this review actually goes on to say, overall, the underlying anti-Sky Wiggins Froome undertone is wearing. Now, we get that comment quite a lot. We also get completely the opposite. We get accused of being pro-Team Sky. We get accused of being anti-Team Sky. We haven't had any voice messages along those sorts of lines. We do get written communication more along those sorts of lines. But let's hear three Chris Froome-related questions that were phoned in now.
Hi, Richard, Lionel and Daniel. This is Doug from southern Spain, long-time listener and friend of the podcast. It's been a fantastic Giro, enhanced as ever by your superb entertaining coverage. I was interested to hear Richard say the other day that Chris Froome would not be stripped of the title even if he loses the adverse and analytical finding case, and even if he loses the Vuelta. Still, many of the articles written talk about the possibility of him being stripped of the title, or of them being an asterisk against his name for the time being. And also when Mara Venyi said that he'd been assured by Lapartien that the result wouldn't be changed after the race, the UCI soon came out with a denial of that. So I'm just wondered why Richard is so sure that the result will stand.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. Ali Hume, a friend of the podcast from Edinburgh. Chris Froome has now won at least two Grand Tours on the time he gained on descending. This used to be his Achilles heel. How much is Froome's dominance just a sign of a great rider being very dedicated to work on his weaknesses?
John from Sussex, friend of the podcast here. Really enjoyed the coverage, guys, and a very exciting Grand Tour. Also enjoyed a certain amount of subtlety that you brought to the coverage of Froome. It was really nice to get something that wasn't, you know, just polarised positions on either side of it. I was wondering, though, particularly, Dumoulin seemed so strong. And the question I have is, you know, how much was he really physically outgunned, or how much was a question of, well, the descent in Froome's second stage win, but also kind of being, you know, making a few unfortunate tactical decisions on that. I mean, perhaps, yes, Froome was stronger on that day, but how much stronger, really, when you partial out all the other factors? He had a stronger team, he got set up better, he was better on the descent, and, yeah, so how much stronger was Froome?
Okay, so we heard three questions there. First of all, Doug from southern Spain, very nice. You mentioned that, you know, that I said on the podcast that Froome would not be stripped of his Giro if his adverse analytical finding case becomes an anti-doping rule violation and he's suspended. It is my understanding, and I think most people's understanding, that a ban would begin the day of his hearing or the subsequent appeal to CAS. You know, if the UCI served a ban, he would very likely appeal it to CAS. In the meantime, he'd be able to carry on racing, and the ban would be from the sort of final verdict on that. As I understand it, am I correct, Daniel?
You are. But that doesn't address the question of whether he is the results he's
I was getting on to
achieved
that.
In the
It is my understanding that results achieved in the interim will stand because he hasn't sort of imposed a ban upon himself like some other riders have done, and they've used that as credit against a ban. If Froome is banned for 2 years from June the 18th, for example, it will be 2 years from June the 18th rather than being dated back to the day of the sample at the Vuelta. But there is some confusion over this. It's not entirely clear. That seems to be what the rules suggest, but there is some ambiguity
There are a few precedents, Rich, which muddy the waters. I mean, the wording of the UCI regulations suggests that he would lose, the results would be disqualified, but then there is this clause about fairness, where fairness requires, and that introduces the idea of discretion. And I think that Sky are very confident that the Giro victory will stand. I think Mauro Vegni, the Giro director, is very confident that the result is going to stand. And there's also, I mean, if you go back and read the Pataki case notes, there's also, with the substance that salbutamol is, you know, it's authorised in a certain respect. There's this issue of habitual use, and if it's established, or if the panel believes that the substance was used habitually, but then there was this abnormal spike, which is consistent with someone basically making a mistake on a particular day, then they carry on using the substance as they previously had afterwards, and they're not going over the threshold, then this was certainly one of the findings in the Pataki case. They decided that fairness required that results after, or certain results after the positive test, should stand. Now, I think I'm led to believe that that would probably happen with Froome. However,
it will be up to, you know, the art.
Yes.
You know, whoever makes the decision in the end. And David Lapartion got himself into a bit of bother because he's clearly assured Mauro Vegni that the G result would stand in the event of a ban. But he's not actually in a position to do that. That might also be his reading of the rules, but it's not actually going to be his decision in the end. So there is a bit of wriggle room to impose a harsher punishment.
Can I just go off on a very, very brief tangent?
Of course.
I mentioned Chernobyl. Did you know that Vasil Kiryenka, in an interview with La Gazzetta dello Sport a few years ago, in fact, it might have been when he won on the Colle delle Finestre, had to deny to La Gazzetta dello Sport, they'd heard a story, and I don't know where they'd heard this story, that his whole family had contracted or had suffered from various forms of cancer, and various members of his family had died because they'd been contaminated by the nuclear waste from the Chernobyl disaster. And it's fair to say that Kiryenka said this was absolute rubbish, and that he's not that far away. Where he was born, I think, it's about 200 kilometers from Chernobyl, but it was not true. But it was an interesting story, and I don't know where it had come from.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks to the listener who rang in about that.
Sorry.
Didn't hear that question. But we did have another couple of questions. One of them was about his descending. Ali Hume from Edinburgh asks about the time he's gained on descending. This used to be his Achilles heel. That is a really interesting point. I mean, Froome has, a lot of people talk about Froome's transformation from, you know, donkey into racehorse in 2011. I'm just quoting there. But a more dramatic transformation in some ways has been his ability to descend, because Froome could barely ride a bike when he started. I mean, I remember in 2010, Team Sky were tearing their hair out. I mean, where do you think Dave Brailsford had a full head of hair at the start of 2010? But Froome couldn't ride in a bunch. He couldn't do the things we were talking earlier on about domestiques. He was a domestique, and he was unable to do a lot of the things that they required him to do, even getting bottles, holding his place in the bunch. He was, you know, and this goes way back, actually. I remember Rod Ellingworth talking about, you know, advising his riders in under 23 races to steer well clear of Froome because he was a liability. And he has become a very, very skilled descender. And, you know, there's arguments about how much time he did make on the descents, but he appears to have made over a minute anyway on stage 19. So it's, yeah, it's testament to, I guess, a lot of practice. But one thing I would like to say, and I'd like to agree with our podcasting rival Lance Armstrong on this, he thinks that, you know, sitting on the top tube should be banned. And I agree with that. I think it's only a matter of time before there's a terrible accident. You know, the first time I saw it was Matej Morhić at the World Championships 2013, winning the under-23 title. Now everybody does it. Froome did it a few years ago. That was another nickname that you coined, a frog on a skateboard, a frog on a matchbox or something. A frog on a skateboard, that was it, wasn't it, Lionel?
Yeah.
But I think it's dangerous. And I think, you know, the bike is not properly balanced. The weight's too far forward. If you hit something, a pothole or something, it's only going to take a rider not quite as skilled at controlling his bike to have a really terrible crash. And it could be banned, and I think it should be banned.
It's only a modern-day equivalent of the old style, which you used to see riders hanging over the back of the saddle instead.
With their hands behind their back, like a downhill skier. Both hands behind their bum, yeah.
I mean, you know, riders have always taken risks on descents to try and get into the most aerodynamic position they can. And fortunately, crashes are fairly rare. But I agree with you on that as well. I think it would. I mean, it's heart in mouth moments. And I suppose more to the point, it's the fact that people may copycat it on the open road and put themselves at really, you know, crazy risks. And if they're not as skilled, you don't want people copying it and coming to grief, do you? But just to address John from Sussex, wondering how much Dumoulin was physically outgunned and how much he was undone on the descent and how much of his defeat owed to a few unfortunate tactical decisions. Well, obviously, on a day like Friday, we had 80 kilometres to watch and try to evaluate in real time what was going on. And I think when you come to analyse it, the difference between Froome and the riders behind, the main difference was that Froome was absolutely committed to that move from the moment that he made it, and will have had in mind what he was going to do and will have known all day that was what he was going to do. And of course, he has the advantage of knowing that that's what he's going to do, whereas obviously Dumoulin is reacting to events. You know, there'll be a moment of doubt, I'm sure. Well, is he really going from here? There's a lag in the information that the riders are getting as well. So when we talk about tactical mistakes, you know, they're dealing with information coming at them that may not be accurate, that may be incomplete, and it's coming at them in kind of a bit of a lag. We have a time gap on the screen, which we take as gospel, but we don't know whether, you know, how absolutely accurate that time gap is. All the rider can do is get information from the team car. And also, you know, the whole thing is a game. It's a tactical game, isn't it? And a sports director will be trying to evaluate what's the best information to give Dumoulin here. Do we tell him this is really getting out of hand quickly and cause him to panic and potentially go into the red and suffer and then struggle to recover from that effort? There's so many little factors going into you know, that race, and in many ways Chris Froome's job was, by several factors, simpler than Tom Dumoulin's, because Froome only had one thing to think about: get up the road, get that gap, try and eke that gap out, and then hold that gap. And he knew how far he had to go. He will have known, you know, he would have chosen that point to go. That's such a powerful thing for a rider, to be in charge of their own destiny rather than being on the back foot and wondering and thinking, well, what have I got here to work with?
I remember
It's just hard to say, tactical mistakes or unfortunate tactical decisions. You know, Dumoulin was doing the best he could with the physical and mental capabilities he had on the road.
Dumoulin rode a near perfect race, you know, for the type of the capabilities that he has. There were days, you know, where he could have perhaps put more time into Froome when he didn't know that Froome was going to emerge as his main rival. But, you know, he couldn't have known that at the time. And a Grand Tour is about managing your effort as well. And over those 3 weeks, Dumoulin was a sort of virtual favourite from the start in Jerusalem in a lot of ways, given what happened to Froome there. And I remember you said last year, Lionel, about Chris Froome successfully manoeuvring his way around France to win the Tour, you know, and the way that he won that race, it was well managed. And Dumoulin very nearly did the same thing at the Giro. The margins were tiny. I mean, 46 seconds in the end, but 20 of those seconds were bonus seconds that Froome picked up by winning stages. Now, I think Dumoulin picked up a 6-second bonus one day. But, you know, I mean, the whole business of one rider riding away from a chasing group is fascinating, because it happened on the road to Zapata as well with Simon Yates, where a lot of people were saying, how on earth can this guy be riding away from a group containing Pinot, Dumoulin, and Froome at that point had been dropped, of course. But it can happen because the group behind isn't as committed. They are all watching each other, and you're not going to get one guy more committed than another guy. It's just not going to happen.
Well, Rich, if that principle didn't apply in every single race that is ever ridden, the biggest group would always be the group that comes in together at the finish, and then every other group would be smaller because, logic...
Well, I guess it depends on the strength of the rider.
Well, I suppose, but we saw it in the Tour of Flanders. How does Nicky Terpstra outride a group of how many guys are in that group behind? And, you know, it does happen.
Or Philippe Gilbert last year at Flanders, which was an even longer escape, wasn't it? About 65 kilometres from memory.
Just on this, lastly, because on the final Giro podcast, stage 21 on Sunday, you asked Richard what my thoughts were, and I went into a bit of a soliloquy about all that we're in danger of missing by trying to reduce performances down to whether they are credible or not. And I think some people take an issue with that and heard it as a sort of unstinting defence of Froome. It wasn't at all. That certainly wasn't the intent at all. But I do think that we're in danger of ironing out the complexities and the conflicts of bike racing and the fact that there are, you know, multiple decisions being made at any one time, and there are lots of other things going on. And part of the fun of it for me is trying to unpick and trying to interpret a few of those things and work out, how it was won and lost. Just on this, an emailed question from Bev Nicholson asking about Sky wants to know whether Team Sky's handling of the press is counterproductive. Something that stood out from the Giro was Dave Brailsford asserting that they hadn't even discussed Froome leaving the Giro, and then afterwards confessing that they had discussed Froome leaving the Giro. She says, I accept that teams will spin their performances, but this stretches it for me. I suppose there's a line here as well, isn't there, about how honest teams and riders have to be in the heat of battle. I mean, nobody wants to show any hint of weakness. There's no way that Sky would say, yeah, actually, we've been considering what to do. You know, we might cut our losses here and focus on the Tour de France. They're not going to say that while the race is going on. I mean, the whole sport is, you know, there's loads of examples of riders trying to kid their opponents into thinking that they're weaker than they are or stronger than they are, depending on the circumstances in the race. And I think if we were to, put people under a sort of lie detector test when they're being asked about kind of tactical strategic points, I mean, I think again, it's fairly unrealistic. And I think it's important to draw a distinction between that kind of, you know, slight hoodwinkery, if you want to call it that, and, you know, answering questions about the probity of performance and, the probity of conduct that's going on in the team. I mean, they're two totally
separate. But this applies as well, Lionel, to this the issue, the episode with George Bennett on when after the stage, Bardonecchia, he made the comment that Froome had done a Landis, and then... you know, I went to speak to him the next morning and he said, well, no, it's been taken completely the wrong way. And of course, yeah, people were fairly cynical about that, jumped in and said, well, of course, the PR team have got onto his back. And yeah, this is almost, I think if you listen to the tone of George Bennett's voice when he's speaking to us the following morning, I think it sounds to me at least fairly spontaneous. It doesn't sound, you know, he wasn't getting a piece of paper out of his back pocket and reading out a prepared statement. However, short of doing a lobotomy, how is it possible to know, you know, to decide whether what he said the previous evening was a Freudian slip, whether it was a deliberate cynical comment, or, you know, all we can do, and we've been criticised sometimes for giving a platform to Dave Brailsford in particular to say certain things, but you know, we can't decide, we don't have the tools available to us to decide what's truth and what's not, unless we decide that 100% of what the guy says or someone else says is lies and is always going to be lies. In that case, we would deny him the platform, but all we can really do is offer the material, and we can, you know, give our listeners, we hope, the freedom to make their own mind up, really.
It's our job, if we're there, to speak to the people who are there and who are key players in the race. Just, I mean, on Team Sky and PR and all the rest of it, they can sometimes appear to be pretty tone deaf to some of the noise. I can understand why they shut a lot of it out, but, you know, I think there was an ill-judged photograph posted on Monday with Froome with the three jerseys from the Vuelta, the Tour and the Giro. Now, there is no denying that that Vuelta victory is certainly not decided yet. There's still a question mark over that while this case is unresolved. So the picture bore a kind of resemblance to a very infamous picture posted by Lance Armstrong, lying on his sofa with his seven Tour de France yellow jerseys hanging up. There was that parallel. But also I just felt that showed disrespect, I think, to the sport when the Vuelta victory is not, I don't think we can consider it confirmed until this case is resolved. And yeah, he may still lose the Giro as well. So that sort of, I mean, if I'm saying that, I'm kind of probably saying he shouldn't have been at the Giro at all, but there's no point in being upset about that after the event. I mean, I think we've spoken about our misgivings about the way that his ride in the Giro was negotiated and announced with this unresolved and the fact that he rode the race. There's no point in going over that again. But I felt, you know, that was a misstep.
Hello, this is Ned here from Lewisham. Keep up the good work, chaps. I've very much enjoyed it. Just listening to your press day episode on my way up to cover a bike race up in Durham. I was struck by what you had to say about wildcard entry to the Grand Tours. And just as a little footnote, because it just struck me as interesting, it might be worth noting that the Tour of Britain over the last couple of years has instituted a kind of points-based qualification system for the UK-based continental teams to avoid any kind of allegations of political manoeuvrings behind the scenes, and to make it fairer and more transparent. And I think it's kind of agreed that that works in the Tour of Britain's case and is probably a better system, albeit because it's based on the general classification. This is quite interesting. Harry Tanfield's stage win in the Tour de Yorkshire recently didn't count towards his team's qualification at all, because it's all based on the general classification positions of their riders, as far as I understand it, across the piece in those races. So whether or not that's workable on the Grand Tours, I very much doubt, but it seems to work for the Tour of Britain. There you go. Don't know if that is interesting. I shall enjoy listening to the rest of your week's work.
Hello, this is Moin Islam, calling from London, a long-time friend of the podcast. My question is around the invitations of Pro Conti teams and wildcards to Grand Tours. I was very impressed, and I think we all were, by the efforts made by some of the Italian teams in their home tour. And has there been any thought given to a more structured way of inviting teams from the Pro Conti levels to the Grand Tours? In as much that I remember Daniel's mentioned in the past that the winner of an Italian competition wins a right to a Grand Tour invitation. But has the Vuelta or the Tour de France ever thought of a similar system? And if not, why not?
Very nice to hear from Ned and Lewisham and Moyin there. Moyin Islam, very good friend of the podcast is Moyin. We've got to know him a bit over the last couple of years because he comes to lots of our events and things. But yeah, the questions from both of them about wild cards, and we have spoken a bit about this. Is there a fair system? If there was one thing that occurs to me, Daniel, if there was a system, it would take away some income, would it not, from the Giro in particular and the Vuelta, who we think, you know, charge quite a lot of money to some of the wildcard teams.
Absolutely, and I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that is one issue. The other issue is this general sheepishness that took hold after the sort of scandal-riddled years of from 1998 through to 2006, that the Grand Tour organisers became afraid of any kind of meritocratic system which was incentivising performance above, well, anything else. So they shied away from stipulating performance-related criteria, which they did used to do. You know, they used to say quite explicitly, if such and such a team performs well in Paris-Nice or whatever, then they've got a great chance of doing the tour. Or so, you know, I think that the time has maybe come to relax a little bit about
is that Rob Hatch in your bar in the background? Yeah.
I think the time has maybe come to relax a little bit about that and just to accept that, you know, it is the races themselves are that they're races, they're competitions, and there has to be some incentivization of performance. I mean, one alternative, I've thought a lot about this, and an alternative, maybe quite a telegenic, made for TV solution with a bit of razzmatazz would be to have a panel of judges that are sort of cycling celebrities, former riders, eminence greases of professional cycling, and have a televised panel discussion where they're in a room for an hour and it's streamed online and they discuss the relative merits of each team and then it's a vote. But where do we ever see that kind of transparency in professional sport when big decisions are made and millions of euros hinge on these big decisions? Because that is the reality. Millions depend on whether certain teams are in these races or not.
What about France Has Got Talent or something, you know, some kind of talent show to get the teams in? We'll suddenly find out that Warren Barguil can play the bassoon or something. I don't know. Or that Lilian Calmejan's a really good juggler.
As long as we don't have to see them in swimsuits.
If that is Rob Hatch in the background, that's his non-commentary voice, isn't it?
He's commentating on Crufts, I think, in the background there.
Oh, dear.
He's very versatile. He's very, very versatile. Anyway, we should finish with one quick question.
Should I put a tenner on Egan Bernal for the Tour de France? Maybe each way.
Well, David, that's an interesting question. I can't answer that question because I don't understand betting. But if you'd asked me a week or so ago, I would have encouraged you to bet. But Froome's performance at the Giro has maybe changed things a little bit. When it was rumoured that Egan Bernal would ride the Tour, I think there were questions in Dave Brailsford's mind about whether Froome would be in a position to really challenge for the Tour de France. We spoke to him actually on the day of the time trial, didn't we, Daniel? And we asked him about this rumour that Bernal might be sent to the Tour de France. And I think we were both left with the impression that although Froome had ridden decently that day, he still seemed to have a long way to go to prove that he could actually win another Tour de France.
Yeah, that's right, Rich. And remind me, Rich, there was the issue of the Dauphiné was brought up, and
he's been withdrawn from the squad for the Dauphiné.
To keep the options open. I've got a start list in front of me, and it's a provisional start list, and he's on it.
Is that a full team, or is that a larger squad than will be the final team?
No, it's a smaller. Is it seven rider teams at the? No, it's eight rider teams at the Dauphiné.
Well, maybe,
so
maybe
there are only
it has
seven.
Changed. Maybe it has changed.
Yeah, so seeing him on there makes me think that maybe there's been another change of heart. Before we get to the Tour de France, it's going to be interesting to see how he goes at the Dauphiné, because there's another rider, Geraint Thomas, who had been groomed as Froome's. That's a very awkward rhyme, isn't it? Deputy for the Tour de France, and that could muddy the waters even further if Bernal outperforms Thomas at the Dauphiné, which on form you would expect he might do.
However, the question was simpler than we were making it. Should he put a tenner on Egan Bernal for the Tour de France? I presume that means to win it.
No.
Well, I would say yes, on the basis that he'll get his stake back if Bernal doesn't start. So do it now. You never know.
Okay, there you are. Well, we should wrap things up. Really sorry we haven't been able to get through all the questions. We got a lot of questions, and we've tried to get through as many as possible. I hope you've enjoyed this experiment. Maybe we'll repeat it at the Tour de France. I think we will. It gives us something to do on a rest day, doesn't it, Lionel?
Indeed. So
we'll rope Francois into that as well. Maybe we'll do it at the Londrette on the second rest day, so we can actually, you know, answer questions about pants and things like that while counting them. Anyway, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week. Oh, a little reminder that this week we have released the latest cycling podcast, Femina. It is it covers all the women's racing throughout the last month. And there's a really interesting interview there with Lizzie Dagnan about impending motherhood and what she will do when she returns to racing. She hints that she may not be with her current team, Bulls Dolmans. So, and it's a really interesting interview that Orla Shinui has done with Lizzie Dagnan. That's out now. We also released the latest episode of the Espoir Diaries for friends of the podcast at the start of the week. We've got another friends special coming, which is a recording of our live show from Hackney earlier this year, with other bits and pieces recorded while we were touring around. That's all coming. Thanks everyone who's signed up as a friend of the podcast. If you haven't, you can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. for £15 for loads of exclusive content. But we'll be back next week. Daniel, you'll be at the Dauphiné. Hope we can hook up with you. Thanks very much. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps. Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.